You are listening to the Poetry Salon Cast, brought to you by the Poetry Salon. Do you need a community of like-minded writers to help you get inspiration, education, and take your writing to the next level? Join the Poetry Salon and get workshops with award-winning writers and poets, which you can access from anywhere in the world. Find out more at thepoetrysalon.com and also find us on Substack. Now, please enjoy our interview with our guest poet. Today's guest poet is Sarah Browning, who will begin by reading two poems from her latest collection, Killing Summer. Here's Sarah.
Petworth, early evening. A man is stabbing women in my neighborhood. Most poor people in my city are Black, and because of the warnings of 400 years, I assume the man stabbing women is Black. Walking home, I pass a young Black man on the sidewalk. When I first spotted him, I did not cross the street, though I thought to. As we pass, he reaches into his pocket, and I feel fear. How white I am. From his pocket, he pulls a phone, calls his girlfriend or grandma or buddy up the street, his job, his pastor, his boyfriend, his AA sponsor. I don't want to be afraid of my neighbors walking home from the metro in the clear light of evening. I want to tear history from my throat. My son is in his room texting his friends. It is June in the 21st century. Hot priests. The calendar hangs on every souvenir stall in Rome, beside Audrey Hepburn and Gregory Peck, circling Piazza Venezia on a Vespa. January's a simple seminarian from Akron, but March smolders in his love of the Lord. A sullen Fabio, his long black hair is brilliantined, a two-day growth on his chin. I check out the live ones who stride purposefully in their gray, black, brown, white robes across the cobbled alleyways and mad boulevards of the city. Young, buff, from all the wondering Christian world, they come to Rome. They study, pray, live in beloved community. Once I start looking, I cannot stop. Peak-faced or angelic, Senegalese, Korean, Filipino, Italian, their robes swish. They swish with their devotion. I am so agog, I quit reading the guidebook, how the Titus Arch celebrates Rome's pacification of the Judaic people, to gaze at their hard backs. I can't help thinking of all that Catholic flesh in the news. And the calendar pinups, are they models or the real thing? Beefcake, true and holy.
Hello, listeners of the Poetry Salon Cast. You have been hearing the voice of Sarah Browning. Sarah Browning is the author of two collections of poems, Killing Summer from Sibling Rivalry Press, 2017, and Whiskey in the Garden of Eden from The Word Works, 2007. Her poems have appeared in Poetry, the Academy of American Poets, Poem a Day, Beloit Poetry Journal, Shenandoah, and many other journals and anthologies. She is co-founder and was executive director of Split This Rock, Poetry and Provocation and Witness for 10 years. She is the associate fellow of the Institute for Policy Studies. She's currently pursuing an MFA in Poetry and Creative Nonfiction at Rutgers University, Camden. Sarah, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much. I'm afraid that's a little out of date. I have finished my program.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I got my MFA in Poetry and Creative Nonfiction, and now I'm teaching online through an organization, wonderful organization, called Writers in Progress.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you for telling me about that. You know, I'm really fascinated by your work in Split This Rock. So when I was first learning to be a poet way Feels like a long time ago. It wasn't that long, just a little over a decade, but I think I was at the first Split This Rock Festival.
Wow.
Yeah, I had lived in Washington, D.C. before I really got into poetry. I was there for about 6 weeks, and then the weather turned cold, and I got real disillusioned and real homesick real fast and moved home, and then started getting interested in poetry. And when the Split This Rock Festival came out, when Split This Rock happened, I said, I have to get out there. And so I was there for, I think it was the first inaugural year. And so when I saw that, you were the executive director, co-founder, I was really particularly interested in talking to you about that. And of course, reading your book, Killing Summer, I can see Washington, D.C. in there. I can see a lot of the political attention, the attention to politics showing up in your writing. So, I know it's kind of two questions, but I do want to ask about the genesis of this book. And if for readers who haven't read it yet, as I said, there's definitely a lot of political awareness in this book. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about kind of that intersection of poetry and politics and how this book came to be.
Thank you. Well, I was raised in an activist family, many of whose members were poets. It didn't mean that they necessarily wrote about political issues, but both these impulses were a huge part of who I am. And but I came of age at a time when we were being told not to write political poetry. I was specifically told that it was not real poetry; it was only propaganda.
Who said that?
Yeah, my poetry instructor, who I won't name, but it was the 80s, mid-80s. It was a really conservative time in poetry. And I gave up writing because I thought, well, if that's not real poetry, then why bother? So I went off and became a community organizer and a political organizer, but poems just kept rising in me. And eventually, it's a longer story, but eventually I was lucky and found my way to Washington, D.C. And it wasn't just luck. My first husband was an academic and he went on the job market and he got a couple of different offers. And one of them was in D.C. And I really wanted to be in what I hoped would be an activist poetry, literary community. And I figured, where else, but DC would I find that? And indeed, I did find that in DC. And the people that I co-founded Split This Rock with are my dearest, closest comrade, poet, loves, my friends, my heart. And so all of the work is in community with them. Even now, I don't even live in DC anymore, but they still are there, my poetry heart. There weren't a lot of institutions in DC at the time, poetry and literary organizations. There were the national ones, like the Library of Congress and the Folger, and there were universities, and there were a few people doing wonderful work, but very on a very small scale. And so when the US invasion of Iraq was looming, and there was a national movement of poets to speak out against the war, I had just moved to DC and I couldn't find a reading. And I reached out to people I could find online, and they said, "Oh no, we haven't, there isn't one, but it'd be a good idea, huh?" So with a week to go, I found a location and put out the word, and 175 people came. And it was an extraordinary event. And that was, 3 weeks before the US invaded Iraq in 2003. And there was so much response, both from the poets and from audiences, that we began doing, we did more events when people stepped up to the plate and we all organized together. And that sort of Split This Rock grew from that and from Reggie Kabiko, incredibly lauded performance poet, first Asian American to win the National Poetry Slam, et cetera. He moved to DC and we immediately hit it off and together, he and I and a number of other really wonderful people, Melissa Tuckey being the main co-founder, co-founded Split This Rock. But before and first dreamed up that it might just be one festival. We didn't know, but people who came to the first festival said, "Oh no, you have to keep doing this." And I know that if we don't have our own organizations, we can't respond. So I wanted to build a home.
Now,
I wanted.
remind me when it was first. The first event, I know the Split This Rock has always been there. What was the title, like the subtitle was Poets Against the War?
No, so Poets Against the War predated Split This Rock. So we were doing Poets Against the War in 2003, four, five, six, and around 2006, we started dreaming of doing something on a larger scale. There was no poetry festival in DC, which seemed ridiculous, and I mean, except for one sort of half day event, but not like a multi-day with national folks. So that's when we dreamed up Split This Rock. Also, I wanted it to have a positive name, not a negative one. I didn't want to be against something. So Split This Rock comes from a Langston Hughes poem. It's not a well-known one called Big Buddy, and it's the stanza is, "Don't you hear this hammer ring? Gonna split this rock and split it wide. When I split this rock, stand by my side." So it had the sort of we're going to split the rock of injustice, but and we have to often do our own writing on our own, but we need community. And that stanza said it all right there. So the
No,
book, and
I just want to say, I remember having that thought. I'm an optimist. And I remember having that thought at the festival, Poets Against the War going, well, when the war ends, what are they going to call this next? What if it ends tomorrow? What will we call this? The name won't be appropriate. Of course, I'm not sure there's been a time where we couldn't say against the war since I've been aware of it.
me
But yeah, I
too.
think you're absolutely right about wanting to put it in the positive, and that Langston Hughes quote really is so appropriate. It's so visceral. And then, of course, people have to go to look up the rest of the poem, so it gets people reading the entirety of the poem as well. So I mean, it's very appropriately named, I think.
Yeah, thank you. We did. It took us a long time to find a good name. I had worked for organizations with not good names previous to that, and I was like, no, we need a good name. So we had everybody brought their favorite poems in this vein, and we had the session that was coffee filled fueled. We had the session that was wine fueled. We had the one that was chocolate fueled. Anyway, we finally came up with this. But the book is called Killing Summer, and the title poem is about gun violence on the streets of the city. And the fact that DC, like so many of our cities, is very segregated by race and class. And when I first arrived in DC and I was sitting in the cafe at Politics and Prose Bookstore, this wonderful independent bookstore in Upper Northwest, or as we called it, Upper Caucasia in DC, it's like an affluent white neighborhood. And, I'd just been reading that morning about, and often the, when young black men died by gun violence, struggles on the streets, what have you. It occasioned a one paragraph notice in the Washington Post. And every day, it felt like, I'm sure it wasn't every day, but at least once a week. And of course, the murder rates have gone up in most of our cities since the pandemic, but it was just devastating to me that I was sitting in this cafe, comfortable, safe, Mostly white, not all, of course, because it's still DC, but mostly white, mostly upper middle class or affluent. And that in our very same city, a small city, just across the town, there were, mothers mourning their children. And that I wanted to feel an invisible thread between me, between us, but I'm at, and these families that are torn apart by violence and people living in fear in their own communities. And yet it's not there. It just felt like there's so much willful ignoring. And there's plenty of money now, and after September 11th, more and more and more and more money being poured into DC as all the defense contractors feeding at the public trough moved to DC and hired lawyers, accountants, analysts, whatever those people do, and et cetera, engineers, mostly young people, mostly white. There's so much money and yet so much poverty. And how do we tolerate it? How do we tolerate it? So that's sort of the origin of this collection, is in that title. But my books, the first two books that you mentioned that have been published, I'm shopping around a third manuscript, which is more thematically unified. But as you can tell, I'm interested in lots of things, and my brain jumps around a lot. So this book, Killing Summer, has poems about what I just talked about, race and class, and examining my own, as in the poem I read first, Petworth Early Evening, my own complicity in the racist project of our nation. But also about being a nerdy girl in high school, about sex, about a year when I was fortunate to live in Italy. It's, it just ranges. It's whatever's kind of pounding up inside me is what I write. And so it makes for this book in particular. One judge didn't choose it, and she told me that it was her second choice, but she felt like it was not organized how she thought it should be. She wanted it more in sections that were thematically linked. So all the political poems and then all the high school poems and then all the Italy poems or whatever. But the poet Tim Siebels and I were talking about this, and he said, but the mind doesn't really work that way.
That topic is really interesting to me, and I like this. I've talked about this with other poets when we discuss their manuscripts, and I think there's this tendency now, especially, to want to have collections that are so tightly wound around a theme. And yet, life is multifaceted, multi-layered. So when I work with people on developing their manuscripts, when I work on my own manuscripts, it's always a question. Do you put these all in sections? How do you organize those sections? Is it, this year, that year, the year after? Is it, these are all the love poems, these are all the poems about travel, these are all the poems about your family? But, when you're living your life, it's, you write your family poem, your love poem, your travel poem, your political poem, your family poem, your love poem, your travel poem. You're dealing with different things at different parts of your life or parts of the day or what have you. So it's not as thematic. We're not living thematically organized chapters of our lives,
Exactly,
So.
exactly. And my mind is, it I'm interested in all kinds of things. My brain jumps around. I have a short attention span. Most of the poems are not long. And so I ended up organizing it more sort of intuitively, this book. So there were just a couple times when I realized, oh no, I put two poems together that are really not appropriate to be next to each other. And I made, as I was finalizing it. But for the most part, I kind of let the poems, I wanted to have see what kind of conversations could emerge from being side by side, very different poems, both in theme and style.
Well, I think the book, it definitely sort of tracks a life experience. The first poem that you have in there, that which is the first poem you read here at the top of the podcast, kind of introduces us to the world of the speaker, obviously, and like living in DC and the political concerns and the social concerns. And then, I think it's the second section you get into some backstory about being the nerdy girl in high school. By the way, listeners, please, if any of you identified as the nerdy girl in high school, I'd say get a copy of this book. There are a lot of nerdy girl poems that I personally resonated with. You didn't read one today, but that's okay. I got to read them. I quite enjoyed them. I identified with them a lot. But it felt very much like, backtracking, going, well, this is how I got here. This is how I got to have my political views. This is how I get to be informed and have this perspective on the world. So it does all kind of build together into a world view, I think. And
Thank you.
so it does feel very coherent that way.
Yeah. My first book, which is called Whiskey in the Garden of Eden, has more poems that are very much origin story poems about my childhood, growing up in an activist family in a multiracial neighborhood on the south side of Chicago in the 60s and 70s, another kind of intensely political time. So there aren't poems on that subject in this book, but I am actually working here. I'm coming to you from the beautiful Virginia countryside at Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, which is a wonderful retreat center. And I'm lucky to be here working on a kind of hybrid manuscript that's poetry and creative nonfiction about my life, but also my family story. On my daddy's side, I'm descended from Virginia enslavers who lived quite close to here and came from a quote prominent family, which meant that they owned a lot of people, and their papers are at the University of Virginia. So I'm trying to write about this kind of grotesque fact. I'm returning to my childhood in ways that I kind of hadn't realized that I would be.
Well, this is a good segue for talking about your poem, the first poem that you read, which opens the book. And I remember reading that poem and going, this is pretty daring stuff. This is, I think there's something in creative writing where it's like you want to start off getting the reader on your side by kind of admitting something about the main character that is, unpleasant or that's harsh or that's self-critical, because then the reader knows that they can trust the narrator, that the narrator's revealed something about themselves. I thought about that with the first poem that you read, because it is the narrator kind of revealing something that might be difficult to admit to, having these thoughts about these prejudices that you see African American man on the other side of the street and immediately feel a sense of fear, and then questioning that, and then saying essentially, well, I don't want to feel this way. So can you talk a little bit about why you chose to make that the first poem of the collection?
Thank you. Yes. Obviously, this was a very hard poem to write. And I was fortunate that I have close friends who are Black poets, who I showed it to. And both of them encouraged me to push it further. Like the line, "How white I am," came from one of them. And that was my, I tended to not say it explicitly. And his point was, with this very difficult material, sometimes you have to say it explicitly. And what I'm saying explicitly is that as a white woman growing up in America, now I'm 61, so I'm hoping things are improving. But certainly when I was a child and teenager in the 60s and 70s, the images that I saw on television and all around me of black men, and it, tragically it continues to be the case, were mostly because they were bit caught up in the criminal justice system. Or portrayed as such in popular, in fictional movies. And so that we're deeply, and obviously it's not just popular culture, it's white women, white people, but there's a particular form of racism that white women are indoctrinated with in fear of black men. And I feel strongly that if we don't acknowledge it, we can't face it. And then we can't begin to heal from it. And it's a healing for us, for white women, for white people, as well as for black people. I mean, we to live, as I said, I don't want to live in fear of my neighbors. It cripples us. But of course, it's much harder to be a black person in America than it is a white person. So I'm not drawing equivalences. I'm just saying that we suffer from it too, and we need to face it. And so I wanted to say that I'm implicated. I'm not pointing fingers. And of course, it's no fun to have a finger pointed at you. You stop reading if you feel like you're just being scolded. So I don't think it's effective as politics or as creative work.
Well, and I think this is probably a subject you, I'm sure, can speak to, because you have written so many poems that are examining our political landscape and also the personal effect. But I'm thinking about what, your former poetry mentors in the 80s said, that it's not, what was it, that political poetry isn't really poetry, it's propaganda. I saw something on Facebook not that long ago where someone was asking that question, or they had showed a poem. They were saying, well, is this really not poetry? I think it's poetry. And then there were, 800 people jumping on top of each other, and then other people jumping on top of those people. This is propaganda. You're on the wrong side of history. How dare you think, of course, this isn't poetry. And furthermore, just like the absolute vitriol that was going on in this conversation of, does this even count as a poem? Is it propaganda? And I won't say what the poem was about, but clearly, it took a viewpoint, and some people were upset about the viewpoint. Some people were actually having a conversation about poetry versus propaganda. All of which is just a long preamble to ask. What would you say is the difference between poetry and propaganda? And especially after getting that early piece of advice from one of your mentors, like how have your thoughts on that evolved?
Well, when I did start writing again, I was lucky to interview. I had a very brief career as a freelance journalist. It lasted about 6 months until I realized, oh, I'm not good at the hustle. But I was lucky that it coincided with when Martina Spada moved to Western Massachusetts to teach at UMass, and I was living there because my first husband was getting his PhD at UMass. And so I interviewed him and asked him about it. And he said, well, people say it's hard to write a good political poem. Yes, it's hard to write a good poem, is what he said. He's like, it's hard to write a good love poem, but no one says stop writing love poems, right? So, yes, there's plenty of political poetry out in the world that is not going to last. But that's true of all poetry, of poems on all subjects. What I look for in a political poem is the same thing I look for in a diff in another poem. Does it excite my senses? Does it move me? Do I does the music move me? Now, sometimes in moments of intense crisis, of course, people write things that may not last, and they put them out in the world, and they may serve a purpose in that moment.
Yes.
They may be a rallying cry, they may function as a a way to encourage people, support them in their activism, etc. And it may not have lasting power, but that doesn't mean it's not a poem.
That's a very fair point. I like your rubric, let's call it. Some of these poems may not last, which is very different from saying some of them aren't poems or aren't good. You know, that's I think a little bit more of a generous metric. You know, the poems that will last versus the poems that won't last. When I see a political poem in the workshop, I always try to give poets the guideline. Think about how this poem will function if someone in Finland reads it 200 years from now. Are they going to know the name of the president of the US in this year? Or will this feel irrelevant to them? And then I try to help them, you know, find the thing that's going to last. How can we make this not just about this political issue and this political season, but how can we make this about something larger?
On the other hand, I mean, yes, but on the other hand, we still read Richard the Third.
Well, some of us do.
and the Iliad. But I mean, these, poems that make reference to despots of the past, for example, it's because we recognize our current despots in these guys,
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not to say that you can't name names or anything like that. I mean, you know, I was just thinking about this with Sylvia Plath's The Bell Jar, and her opening sentence is something like, "Well, that was the summer that they killed the Rosenbergs." I mean, clearly very much of the time, but then the rest of the books winds up being much more personal and about her personal struggle. So it's not to say you in fact, you always want to make it clear what the details are and of the time and make us know what year this takes place and everything. But it also has to be about something that lasts beyond that too. You know, like Romeo and Juliet, like, yes, that takes place in Padua, and they're very clear about what year it takes place, and the costumes tell you what year it takes place. And you know, it's the story that we could tell about what's going on down the street today, you know. So it's got to have that combination of things.
And tragically, it doesn't look like we're getting rid of war anytime soon, or poverty or inequality. Or the infringement on the rights of women's bodies, I don't think any of these topics are off the table.
Yeah, I really wish the optimistic part of me wants to say like, well, this will all be solved and no one will understand this 100 years from now, but I have a feeling that that won't be the case. I have a feeling like we're going to be dealing with these issues for a very long time, and you know, who knows how long any of these poems will feel you know, of the moment. So Killing Summer, the poem that you read at the top, what year was that you first drafted that poem?
That poem is called Petworth Early Evening. And I'm guessing that was 2013. So that's more than 10 years ago. I had to move out of Petworth when my marriage split up, and the neighborhood had gentrified so much that when I let my ex-husband keep the house, I couldn't afford to rent there. Well, so, but that's why it tells me that's the date I have before and after.
There we go. Yeah.
But I'm a slow writer and I'm a slow reviser of my work. So it takes me a while.
Yeah, and to say more on that topic too, obviously you and I are both white women, and so obviously this is an issue that I find very, I don't want to say near and dear to my heart necessarily, but definitely something that I resonate with a lot, and wanting to, wanting to participate in the conversation, wanting to find your own way into it. Oh, that's what I had wanted to say. Did you read Matthew Zapruder's book, Why Poetry?
No, I haven't yet.
I keep recommending it to folks, especially anyone who is writing political poetry. And he has a wonderful chapter in there where he references Ford. Yeah, it's her poem Power. And the quote is, the difference between poetry and rhetoric is being ready to kill yourself instead of your children. And the poem goes on to have her talking about something she's aware of that really bothers her and makes her very angry. And then she turns the poem back on herself, saying, like, this is what I'm finding out about myself is how, how angry I am. I'm probably doing not the best job of summarizing it, which is why everyone should go and read the poem itself. But I really kept that in mind whenever writing political poetry, whenever trying to help anyone else with their political poems, is asking the question, where does the poem turn on you? Where does
Yes.
the camera lens turn around and point to you and reveal something about you? And I think the poem you read at the top is just such an excellent example of that, turning that lens back on yourself, saying, like, why am I feeling this way? I don't want to feel this way.
Yeah.
This is
Yeah.
revealing something uncomfortable about myself,
Right. Right. Because we're implicated. I mean, our tax dollars are paying for the murder of children in Gaza at the moment. We're buying smartphones that are made by people who are not much above the status of enslaved people, or components of them, or mining for them. The way that we benefit from this horrific disparity of wealth internationally. With it, cheap consumer goods, cheap clothes. I mean, we're all implicated. And drug cartels in Mexico, it's all driven by demand in the United States. All that horrific violence, if we just legalized drugs, there'd be an enormous change. So, we are implicated in all of this, driving our cars, ruining the earth, So I have a poem in the book that's called Gas, that's all about making fun of myself for, my activism, and at the same time driving my car everywhere and loving my car. But what the fuck are we going to do? I'm sorry, can I say that word? It's a
I
podcast,
don't
right?
think I have a policy.
Okay.
Yeah, you could say that word.
Okay.
I deem it appropriate to say
Thank
that word.
you. We have to make choices, and unless, I mean, very few of us can live completely off the grid.
Yeah, it's very frustrating.
So a young activist asked me, or was in a writer was asking me this question. And I said, well, I don't eat beef. I buy mostly used clothes. And I I try to live simply. And then
Mm-hmm.
I try to, and then I do a ton of work to try to get people elected who will change our policies,
Yeah.
which is most important, although our consumer habits are important too. So it's tough, but in writing our poems, absolutely, we have to examine our own selves, and we have to ask where we fit in the world. And that's part of our the role of poetry anyway, is who am I and who am I in relation to others? Who am I in relation to the society I find myself? And who am I in relation to the earth?
No, that's absolutely true. And I think when we look at politics in poetry, you're right. You can write a bad political poem just like you can write a bad love poem. It's any time that you're failing to do one of the things that's essential for poetry to do. I feel like maybe it's just my own lens, but I feel like it happens worse in political poems, which is why, I guess some people have that feeling that, political poems shouldn't be poems. But I definitely feel like that landscape is changing. I feel like I've read so many really wonderful poems that, you could classify as political poems, and I definitely don't feel like you're going to get any professors these days saying you can't write political poems or don't, because they seem to be quite in vogue right now.
Well, we're living through very difficult times. People in power have had to begin to listen to those who have historically been out of power or on the margins. But it's the change is recent. I mean, we started Split This Rock because all the prizes, all the university professorships practically, all the poet laureates were white men, and often, usually white men who were not writing about the horrors of that were surrounding us. So Split This Rock intentionally wanted to make visible the people who were writing this incredibly powerful work. It's not that they weren't writing it, it's that it wasn't getting the kind of recognition that it warranted and that would bring it a large audience. So everyone quotes Audre Lorde now, but in the 70s, she was dismissed as just being for Black women or just being for lesbians or just being for feminists. So same with June Jordan and Adrienne Rich and all these poets who we now revere tremendously and are quoted all the time, they were ghettoized by the literary establishment. And so you had to know about them to go find them at the time that they were alive.
That is really an interesting perspective. And I mean, I obviously am coming up in a different time period, because it's like, as long as I've been studying, I've heard Audre Lorde and Nikki Giovanni and all of these poets who to me they're like, this is the canon that I'm growing up with now,
Which is fantastic. I mean, but I should say, if you grew up in a political Black family, for example, or Chicano family, you would know about the Black Arts Movement poets, or you would know about the Chicano Arts Movement poets. But a lot of folks weren't in those environments and didn't know them. The incredible short story writer and poet Grace Paley. Do you know her work?
No.
Oh, well, she's a contemporary of those that we've been talking about and should be known by everyone, just as those folks are. But we brought her to campus as the group that was agitating for a women's studies program at Harvard when I was there in the mid-80s. And not a single member of the English department faculty came to her reading.
Oh, wow.
None. That's how bad it was. And the enormous changes at the last minute and the little disturbances of man are two of the most brilliant collections of short stories ever. So if that's a form that interests anybody listening, I hope you'll go out and read them if you haven't. But in any case, many other organizations also helped make this change. Of course, the ones that serve specific groups, Cave Canem for Black poets, Kundiman for Asian poets, etc. They have made a tremendous impact. And then the poets themselves who just kept writing the incredible work and getting it out there. So yes, we've seen an enormous sea change in the last 15 years, but it doesn't mean it necessarily could, is going to last if we don't keep pushing, keep bringing these voices forward, and keep teaching the poems that really are these brilliant poems, of which there are, as you say, just hundreds, extraordinary poems. I mean, it's a real flowering of socially engaged poetry in America. People from other parts of the world look to the United States, which is kind of shocking to me because we think of other countries as being places that love poetry more. But one of the things about America, and I was, there's international artists here with me at VCCA, and one of them is a has lived in the US for a long time, but she grew up in Brussels and Italy, and she's like, it's the mashing up of all these different cultures and all these different experiences and all these different histories that makes America such an interesting place. And that is true. That's how, and that's what is so devastating to me about the fear that so many white people have and that Trump has tapped into, when in fact it's our great beauty, it's our great gorgeousness. And there's never been a time when there was a monolithic, American whiteness, but that is their dream, for some of them. And I think it's born of fear. And I keep wanting to say, look at this beauty. What do you have to be afraid of?
I'm not an expert on all the world cultures, but I suppose that is probably true that America has one of the one of the most unique backstories in that regard of being the melting pot,
Yeah, I
and
mean,
of course we're making some really interesting poetry here on that and many other topics.
right. And people have come here from all over the world, and these meetings and these both intentional and kind of, smashing into each other in weird ways, but learning from each other and reading each other's work and queer poets and trans poets. I mean, it's just, there's something that has historically been about being sort of on the edges that has pushed the language in all kinds of ways. And so there's all kinds of creative juice coming out of so many corners. And also where it's a huge country. Like when I was at Split This Rock, I kept trying to keep up with the socially engaged poetry being published. I have given up. It's just there's so much. I mean, obviously I try to read when I can, but there's no way I can read everything that's coming out. It's just there's it's an
No,
incredible flowering.
that's the hazard of the trade. Every time I walk into a bookstore, I just, get overwhelmed by the number of books that I'm not going to get to read or going to AWP this year. I was just like, I'm not even going to attempt to say hello to all the poets I want to say hello to. I'm just going to take it one at a time, and no, I'm probably not going to get one third of what I'm of what's available here. Which is, it's a What's that phrase? It's a embarrassment of riches.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a beautiful time.
I do want to move us on to the other portion, which is I want to ask you about the second poem you read and the what I presume is the easier poem, which was a really fun one, quite a contrast to
Yeah.
what we've been talking about. So could you say a little bit about the genesis of that poem?
Absolutely. And I chose it as an easier as one of the easier poems to write, because every so often, like, right, a poem comes as a kind of gift. You just don't do much to it, it arrives and you're like, oh, that's pretty good. And you show it to other people and they're like, yeah, you could change this word here and there, but otherwise go send it out, So this was one of those poems that arrived as a gift. So that's why I chose it. And also because it's humorous, and I do have I like funny poems, and I write them from time to time. So I always try to include them in a reading. I always figure sex or love, funny, political. That's all. There should be at least one of those in every reading when I give a poetry reading.
I like that. I really like that as a guideline. I'll keep that in mind for my next reading.
Yeah, and on an upbeat note, yeah. As I mentioned, I was lucky to live in Italy for a year. My first husband had a job for two jobs. First, we were in Rome, and then we were in Turin, which in Italian is Torino, in the northwest of the country. My son was 10, which turns out to be just an amazing time to travel with a kid. He was interested in everything. He turned 11 while he was there, and he has cousins in Switzerland, so they came down for his birthday. And he just was a fabulous travel companion, and he and I did a lot together. It was the year after we had our first Split This Rock Poetry Festival. We didn't have an organization yet. So Melissa Tuckey, who I mentioned earlier, she was back home, like, filing the incorporation papers while I was and putting together a board of directors. But I did do a bunch of grant writing and helping to plan the second festival while I was in Italy, because the festivals were every 2 years. There hasn't been one since before the pandemic, and I'm not sure what's going to happen next because I stepped down several years ago. But in any case, the point is I had more time to travel around with my kid. So when we lived in Rome, it was only 3 months, and we couldn't afford the international school. And we couldn't find like a dual language program in the public school. So it seemed like it wouldn't be fair to my kid to plop him into an Italian school for 3 months and then yank him out again. When we got to Turin, we found a really good public school for him, and he learned Italian. But for those 3 months in Rome, I Rome schooled him. So we went to museums, churches, the ruins. We learned some Roman history. He and I did some writing together. We had a family blog, which it's actually still up. People can look it up. Every day is pizza day dot blogspot.com. And it has his writing and my writing, and family members could follow us, and pictures, of course. And then yeah, it was really cool. So Rome, for anybody who hasn't been there, is the most extraordinary city. It's also incredibly chaotic and just mobbed with tourists all day, every day. And there are these tourist kiosks that sell tchotchkes, keychains and aprons with the David on them, so that the special part falls right at your special part. Which, of course, I bought like 10 of those to give to my friends. But also, there was this priest's calendar, and there's a gondolier's calendar. And I'm like, it really has these hot priests in these pictures. And I'm like, what? Is this for real? So that's where the poem comes from. And then, of course, It is also a religious center of the world of the Catholic Church. So there are a lot of religious folk there, nuns and priests and lots of different orders, and they're all in different kinds of robes, as the poem says. And so I found myself checking out the live priests, and then it felt like, so there was this kind of weird inversion of the male gaze, and I'm objectifying the male priests, and so that was weird. But I was still curious whether they were models or not. So months later, we go to Venice. And of course, the gondolier calendar is everywhere. And who's the cover boy for the gondolier calendar but our gondolier? Because, of course, we had to take a gondola ride because we're in, Venice. We did one. And there he is. It's our guy. So I guess they're real priests and they're real gondoliers.
That's so naughty. That's the only word that's coming into my head right now, like a bunch of, hot priests posing for hot priest calendar. What is that photo shoot like?
Yeah, but they're not. I want to make clear they're, it's just mostly headshots. It's not, they're, it's not real, they're not beefcake shots. They're not posing, or I mean, they're not draped like odalisques on divans or anything like that.
Forget buying the poetry books. Everyone's going to go buy the hot priest calendars now because
Yes,
that, that's what we're really here to promote.
right. And it's not called Bob Priests. It's just called Priests.
All right. That
Yes.
does seem a little more tame now that you
Yeah.
put it that way.
But obviously, there's a reason. And there they are, as I said, next to the postcards of the Gregory Peck and Audrey Hepburn. That's from the movie Roman Holiday, which, if folks haven't seen it, it's just a fantastic romantic comedy from the f 1950s, where Audrey Hepburn is a princess from some unnamed middle European country and pretend and slips out of the palace and pretends to be not be a princess. And Gregory Peck is a journalist and stumbles up upon her and pretends to not know who she is. And they have like 24 hours together around Rome of the 1950s, which it hasn't changed that much from, at the, in the center of the city. So it's a cool taste of Rome if you get a chance to see the movie.
And that poem just came out
Pretty
just
much
pretty
just,
much completed.
yeah, pretty much just like it is in the book. And it happens sometimes. Some, where you think about it, what shape should it take? I think that one's in tercets, which means three line stanzas and then a single line on its own at the end. Beefcake, true and holy. Hard not to leave that one on its own. But somebody who I was talking to about lengths of stanzas said, well, four line stanzas, quatrains, are very stable. And two line stanzas, we use often couplets when talking about love or relationships, because it's two lines, two people, or if you have two themes. But tercets, these three line stanzas, are more unstable.
Oh, that's so interesting. I often joke with folks that, for me, line breaks, and I would also say probably, those kinds of forms are my, they're the things I am the worst at as poet. And I've gotten better, and I've read some interesting essays and articles that have helped me understand when to break the line better. I can talk about it more confidently now, but I always joke it's to me what turning left is for Derek Zoolander. I'm very embarrassed because I can't do it very well and I should be able to. So that's a really wise little tidbit that I'm going to tuck away for future knowledge. Couplets for love and quatrains are more stable, and the Tercet is the unstable, which I assume would kind of lend itself to maybe sexier poems and, you know, poems where we're a little bit off kilter. So,
right, and the chaotic city of Rome.
Which, by the way, I have been to Rome. I'm very fortunate, very lucky that I've been to Rome. And that is, yeah, absolutely such a strange mashup of like religion and then the Colosseum, but it's also the Catholic religion. And then it's just, you know, sex and supermodels. And it's just everything. It's yeah. All these contradictory forces akimbo in one place. It's such a, everyone should go. If you can make absolutely. It, go.
Yeah.
And absolutely. The pizza's great.
Yeah. And I loved that you can, you turn a corner and there's a Byzantine church leaning up against a first century arch, leaning up against a 19th century apartment building. And it's just, and it's not a museum. It's just people wandering about their daily lives, and that's their neighborhood.
I know. I can't imagine what it would be like to actually live there on a regular basis. To just, oh, I'm walking past the Colosseum on my way to, you know, get a taxi on my way to go and file some report. And I can't imagine being there as a citizen and not as tourist. But who knows? One day maybe I'll get a chance to experience that and, you know, retire there. But yeah, we can hope. We're getting close to the end. In fact, I've held you a little after. So I just also wanted to ask, and you've already mentioned a couple names, but would you say there were any poets you were particularly reading or taking influences from as you were working on Killing Summer?
Lucille Clifton. Always. Her concision and her way of with a single image making absolute magic. There's a poem, I think it's called Poem to My Uterus, that refers to the uterus as estrogen kitchen, you know. Just brilliant. I was also reading a lot of Tim Siebel's,
mm-hmm.
his the music of his poetry and the way he can draw out an image over an extended period. What I can't do that he can do brilliantly is form. He writes a lot of villanelles, and I think the villanelle is his favorite, and it always kind of amazes me what he can do. With that, let's see, who else was I reading at that time? I'm trying to think about the festivals that I was organizing at the time, because that's who I was reading. You know, Ocean Vuong's early work.
Mm-hmm. Ocean Vuong, yeah.
Yeah, Ocean, we published his... We started a Poem of the Week series to sort of build momentum to the second festival, because the first festival had all these very famous poets, and the second one, we felt like they weren't as famous. Of course, now they have become so, but so we started sending out a poem a week in the lead up to the festival of those who were going to be featured, and it was a big hit. And so we decided after that, to invite anybody who had attended either of the first two festivals to send us poems to continue this Poem of the Week project, sending out a poem every week. And the very first one that we sent in this new regime, whatever, was by Ocean. He was about 23, you know?
Oh, wow.
I know, it was kind of extraordinary. But I should say, all those poems and others that won Split This Rock contests and such are on Split This Rock's website at splitthisrock.org in a poetry database called The Quarry.
Mm-hmm.
And it is searchable by social issue as well as by the poet's name and location and identity if they've shared that information. So it's a really great resource for wonderful poems about, if your heart is broken about a given issue at a given moment, or you're going to a demonstration, or you're sending a newsletter and you want to include a poem, please go to splitthisrock.org and do a search in the database. It's over 600 poems.
Wow.
So, that was the origin of that was, I remember the Poetry Foundation has, of course, this huge poetry database on their website, and they had one category called politics, and the others was like autumn,
Yeah.
grief, and I was like, well, what if we broke that down further? So that's
I know you
what we
could.
did with a whole lot fewer resources, like on a magnitude of, yeah, a million to one. So, but it
Well,
is a pretty extraordinary thing. So I recommend it to listeners.
we're walking away with extra prizes here. Yes, I want to recommend again Get Killing Summer by Sarah Browning from Sibling Rivalry. And also, yes, visit, say the website again.
Splitthisrock.org.
And there's more than 600 poems on there for everyone to look at. And I would just recommend getting involved with them, especially if you're near DC, if you like DC, if you're willing to travel to DC. I remember going for the first one, and it still really just sticks out in my mind as being such a it's just such a tremendous experience as being both a poet but also a politically engaged poet. I got to meet some of my still current favorite poets there. And I got to meet some wonderful people who I'm still in touch with and still friends with. So if you can get involved with that. Get Sarah Browning's books, plural books. And depending on when you're listening to this, you might not be too late to check out our reading with Sarah coming up in May, the third Sunday in May. It'll also be archived on the Poetry Salon's YouTube channel. So if you're listening to this in the distant future, you can also check out the reading on the YouTube channel. Once again, Sarah Browning, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much. What a great hour.
You have been listening to the Poetry Salon Cast, brought to you by the Poetry Salon. If you enjoyed this interview, you can find out more about the events we offer, the workshops and editing services that we host online, and a variety of other ways to get involved with the Poetry Salon by going to www.thepoetrysalon.com. You can also become a member of our free Facebook group, The Poetry Salon Online, and you can also find me, Tricia Faye Hefner, at Poet Tricia on Instagram. Thanks for listening.